The Federal Reserve is now declaring war on inflation. That's going to require a 180-degree reversal of the Fed's current bubble-blowing policies. How will the markets react?
We have seen the single biggest pivot in monetary policy in the U.S. since Volcker. That we have an interesting situation that in American history, we've only had two presidents ask the Fed chair to hike rates. The first one was Carter, and the second one was Biden. And I don't think the magnitude of that imposition for the market is yet to dawn on them.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Adam Taggart, founder of Wealthion, welcoming you back for another week of making sense of money and the markets so that you can make better informed decisions about building your wealth. Well, the new year is nearly upon us. What will it bring? To tackle that tough question, we're bringing back the man who back last December made several of the most accurate predictions for 2021. And I'm thrilled to welcome Steen Jacobsen back to the program. Steen is the chief economist and chief investment officer at Saxo Bank, which manages billions in client assets. A year ago, he predicted we were about to see higher inflation and a boom in commodity prices, and sure enough, we got both. Steen, it's wonderful to see you again, my friend. Thanks so much for working late at your office in Copenhagen to speak with us here.
Absolutely no problem, Adam. I always enjoy our talks, and I've always done it over the years, so absolute pleasure to be questioned by you today, Adam.
Well, thanks. We got a lot of questions for you, so you may regret that statement. But why don't we start with the one I like to ask you at the beginning of each one of our interviews, just at a high level. What is your current assessment of today's global economy and financial markets?
That we have seen the single biggest pivot in monetary policy in the U.S. since Volcker. That we have an interesting situation that in American history, we've only had two presidents ask the Fed chair to hike rates. The first one was Carter, and the second one was Biden. And I don't think the magnitude of that imposition for the market is yet to dawn on them before we move to this accelerated tapering, which for the record, I think the viewers need to understand, tapering is about taking away liquidity. Interest rate hikes is about impacting the full economy. Very different in the way it works towards the markets. And that sets me up to the actual answer to your question, which is that as we look into 22 right now, we are looking at a very large drag on fiscal in the US to the tune of 6% nominally, allow for some of the spend that happened this year not to have been used yet and some run rates that runs into this year, but probably a 4% financial drag. On top of that, we have, of course, the fact that the Federal Reserve biggest judgment error was the fact that they decided to run the economy so hot that it went beyond the limit of the structural ability of the same economy to provide the goods needed, which means we have a structural deficit that probably after the base effect of all of the one-off things coming off will leave us at a 4% inflation. So what I looked into in 22 is the following. It is a very aggressive monetary tightening, relatively speaking. It's a small fiscal drag in total number, and it is a continued supply chain issue that will leave inflation at a much elevated level relative to what we perceive, meaning that we come strong into the first part of the year, and we probably end in absolute growth around zero, which I think offers me, in a simplistic way, a 70% probability of plus minus 10% and a 30% probability of more than a 30% correction.
Okay, wow, a lot in there. You did a great job of packing a lot into a succinct answer. So if I can just sort of restate what you said, it sounds like you think that the year may start well from economic growth standpoint, but kind of end the year, I think you said, roughly flat. There's going to be a fiscal drag as the fiscal policy spigot gets tightened, not totally turned off, but tightened. And you see the monetary tightening coming in with tapering and maybe some rate hikes. And as a result, I think I heard you say maybe a 30% chance of a material market correction.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think what we need to handicap is the market's reaction to this increase in the absolute inflation level. And by no means do I think the market yet contemplate or even understand that when you take the tapering away, you're removing all of the liquidity provision there is in the marketplace. So that's a direct impact on what we call the financial market. In terms of the impact on the real economy, that has so far been sort of supported by the fiscal spend that we've seen. That fiscal spend has a run rate in the early parts of 22 that's still benefiting. But as we come into the tail end of the year, it's absolutely collapsing because the nominal GDP fiscal drag right now looks like 6%. And then again, adjusted for different sort of overshoots, we probably have a 3 to 4%. So, if we hadn't had the huge fiscal over the feed from 2021 in terms of fiscal, we'll be looking at stagflation light. But due to this, relatively high level of activity that we enter Q1 with, I think we will be safe from that. But the impact will be the same because the dollar what a dollar buys you in purchasing power by the end of the year have been eroded by 6% roughly, and the ability of the low income brackets to sustain that, both in affordability in housing, affordability in cars, affordability in durable goods, is way below index 100. So we're seeing a hollowing out of the middle and low income brackets, which will hurt consumer spending as well.
Okay, all right. So that's going to hurt consumer spending. It's probably going to place a lot of political pressure, I imagine, on the current administration. 2022 is an election year, largely for Congress. So many questions for you, but why don't we tackle inflation first? Especially because that was sort of your, home run, knock it out of the park prediction that you made when I talked to you a year ago, last December. You called for a commodities boom based upon that, and man, boy, do we ever get one. You also pointed out how the physical economy was becoming the rate limiter of the digital economy, that the digital economy was actually growing faster than the physical economy's ability to actually get stuff delivered. And you said all this before 2021 arrived and all the supply chain constraints that we've been feeling all year long. So first, I want to give you kudos for making such a prescient call there. You've just said that you continue to see inflation being an issue, especially hitting the lower classes. You mentioned that the limitations of the supply chain are going to persist through a lot of 2022, presumably keeping prices elevated still because of those issues. As you look forward, how does this higher inflation change the game from a macro standpoint, from, say, what you were thinking a year and a half ago? Presumably, you might not have been thinking it was going to be as high as it is now. Correct me if that's wrong. But as you look to 2022, like, is inflation going to be still the dominant theme of the year, or will it be slightly moderating?
So I did expect, and I restated 7% objective for CPI about 3 4 months ago, which was also laughed at. And now we probably gonna end at a terminal inflation rate above 8%, essentially, as things look right now. But I think you're right in pointing out that if you look to 22, there are of course base effects on inflation that potentially takes it down. There is also, and maybe that's my out of the consensus call for 22 is, I think we see that certainly in China and Europe. I think we have an energy crisis. I think we will get a deeper energy crisis as we come into the cold month. And if you look from the core of your question there, Adam, I think what that translates into is a potential inflationary impact to come from energy. And through energy, there will be a fiscal need to subsidize the lower income. Certainly in Europe, we already see the British government being willing and able to do that. We've seen the French government, the Italian government, we've seen the Indian government. So a lot of governments right now is forcing and changing this policy. What is even more interesting from an allocation point of view is that I think I briefly talked about it last year as well. The green transformation as a concept, probably better umbrellaed into ESG overall, but inside the ESG, I think the environmental, the E, has been the bigger part. And that's created and was probably my ability to predict anything was really based on my understanding of the green transformation being inflationary in its nature, because here you have let's make it simple, basically trying to force everyone to drive an electric vehicle as a solution to CO2 emission. If you do that, you are certainly decarbonizing in terms of the CO2 emission, but you're re-metallizing the whole economy. And what you're re-metallizing is the mining industry, which has the lowest CapEx expenditure in the world. And on top of that, you need baseload energy that comes from the fossil energy, which is the only sector, except for the mining sector, that sees less flow. As we come into 22, we will get a cool winter and we'll get the lowest CapEx expenditure to the baseload of electricity. That creates two impulses. One is social, and I think that's important that we discuss that. The other one is on prices, that the inability of baseload electricity be degenerate. And make no mistake, baseload electricity demand grows them more than the nominal GDP. In other words, there is still a more and more electricity being consumed globally. But as the winter kicks in and the ability to get that, the marginal price, as we right now in Europe, has the highest energy prices ever in history. Why do we have that? Because we have low storage, because we are underinvesting in capacity, and because we have a grid network which, similar to the US, is totally incapable of actually dealing with renewable energy, which is a non-constant velocity into these turbines that does the electricity. So a long way of saying this is that the outside chance and the 30% downside comes from the fact that we can have an overshoot of that. I mean, I, God forbid, I became the last thing I want to be is a virologist. The second last thing I want to be is a Met guy trying to predict the weather. But I'm actually going to do this anyway and say there is a 70-80% chance that the global weather this winter will be very cold for two reasons. Statistical facts, both of them. One is that we have La Nina, which makes the seawater colder. And the other one is that the polar vortex, which is the wind that blows from the north, is increasing in the higher altitudes, which means we're getting more cold weather sent down from the North Pole and the likes in terms of the weather. So the demand is up. Most interesting for us as investors, the capital expenditure is the lowest ever into mining and fossil energy at the time where you need it the most. Okay, then on to the social part. So the social part is that, of course, it hollows out the purchasing power of consumers. That's easy to understand. But the second part, and this is something you even see in the U.S. I don't know where you noticed, but was it in Michigan? No, it was in Illinois. You had an atomic power plant that was decommissioned. All of a sudden, it was put online again. You had the English Illinois. Government. Yeah, Illinois, right? And then you have, in England, you have coal-burning utilities that was re-established. You have the Japanese government now increasing the amount of spend in the fossil energy sector. You have a huge amount of pivots, which is kind of interesting because, you know, if you woke me up 2 months ago and asked me what is the biggest political narrative, political capital invested today, I would have said ESG if you woke me any time, any day. Now I'm saying, hang on a minute. All of a sudden, this green transformation story is superseded by something more important, which is that when you turn on the switch at your office or in a bedroom, there's actually electricity coming out. And right. All of a sudden,
light and warmth basically is superior to the ESG drive.
Yeah, which go to our psychological profile, right? You know, what do we essentially need? We need security, food, and being warm, right? So it's kind of interesting that, you know, despite the fact that I still consider ESG and the whole green transformation push the biggest ever, we have never gone further back in terms of this than we did in 22. And I think the price for that will be paid in 22, because what we see is that China is not delivering, India is not delivering, Russia is not delivering on the protocol to reduce CO2 emission. Yes, China has a 2060 objective, but right now, this minute, China consumes 30% of all the electricity in the world, of which 70% is produced by coal. Germany, who is supposed to be a green country, has never burned more coal than they do this year because they decommissioned nuclear power. So the political is up in the air. And I mean, next week in the EU, you have a meeting about reclassifying energy. And I perceive and expect fully that inside the next 12 months, we will see a reclassification of nuclear and we see a reclassification of natural gas. Just for the record, in Asia, nuclear neutral gas is perceived to be a green energy, whereas in the Western world and the US, we still perceive it to be a fossil energy. So what I'm trying to say is kind of a convoluted way of saying, I think we stand in front of some of the biggest 180 degree pivot points we ever seen in macro history. We got it in Fed policy because, you know, the Federal Reserve was told by the White House, listen, Mr. Powell, you have failed. You focus on 8 million people being unemployed. What about the 200 million Americans at work who is getting a smaller and smaller paycheck because you continue to ignore the inflationary impact through this nonsense of transitory? If you want to have the chair job again, if you want to have Brainard to be the vice chair, then you change your tune. And immediately, even at his press conference for the re-election, he talked bullish. Now I'm predicting in the energy space, we'll have a reclassification, which will make the spectrum wider in terms of what we consume and invest into. Don't forget, in a lot of legislative areas like the EU, taxonomy, also i.e. the payout, the support, the government grants is based on a certain concept. That concept needs to be broadened out, otherwise you create additional concerns. The problem is it's too late. It's 12:05, and that is too late to react for the Fed. It's 12:05 for the energy because we already have a window that is too cold. So what I'm trying to say is that the real upside shock next year is that I should be sitting here saying, I actually think we're going to have a 10 to 12% inflation because energy is just going to shoot to the star until we get this reclassification. And through that, we allow the capex to flow. But you know, I know, Adam, it takes 4-5 years to get a nuclear power station up and running, you know, similar to the semiconductor issue we have. So for me, I you know, if I'm honestly, brutally honest, I think 22 is going to be the single biggest macro change year in history from a point of view that we are the end of the road of everything. You know, quantitative easing doesn't work anymore. It's political untenable because it plays to the rich people, basically, in the narrative of the left. The ability of Fed to produce electricity is zero. The ability of the political spectrum in the US to do anything in a midterm election, nada, zero. So we are left at the destiny of a market with 90% government control, but that 90% government control is just going to get things worse. But inside that, I think it's going to be a great trading year because there is huge amount of changes at the periphery in blockchain technology, in next-gen medicine. There's a lot of areas I'm super bullish about, but this continue to kicking the can down the road is going to die, in my opinion, in 22.
All right. I want to get to those areas you're bullish about in just a second. Steen, you eloquently made a number of really important points there. And thank you. I had a bunch of questions here, which you kind of answered along the way. But kind of at the core of what you're saying is 2022, I was going to summarize it as saying, kind of like you're saying, it's the year of the pivot, but then you said it's the year of where we really reach the end of the road in everything, which is very soberingly declarative, but I totally understand why you're making that point. So just some key things I pulled out of what you said there is because of the energy, you know, we've underinvested in it. We've got this cold winter coming up. You and I talk a lot about, we often see through an energy lens because we know that the economy doesn't happen without energy, right? So if energy input costs are going up substantially, as it sounds like you think they will, that's going to trickle through into many other, you know, good prices and whatnot. So I think I heard you say maybe we're going to experience more like 10 to 12% inflation over 2022, largely because of those increases in energy prices and some of the continued constraints there in the system. That's pretty big. On the energy side too, the social side that you were talking about, where suddenly, you know, maybe we're changing our mind a little bit about some of these fossil fuels that we can't divest from them as quickly as we thought. And, you know, we might be looking at them with a little bit of a different perspective now, maybe even sort of reclassifying some of them. So maybe natural gas, maybe nuclear become more on the green side than they are on the pollutive side right now in the public or national consciousness. I just want to talk about nuclear for one second since you mentioned it. You know, uranium has had a bit of it's had its best year in a long time this past year. Do you expect the interest in uranium to continue given this potential reclassification of nuclear?
And I expect that some of these new mini atomic power generators that you can do through what's it called, the safe nuclear things to happen. I mean, some of these new nuclear power stations isn't more than a 40-foot container that you
These are
can
the
plug.
SMRs, the small modular reactors.
Yeah, exactly. That was the word I was looking for. So these small modular, and we have a number of experiments in urine going on. And what is interesting is from a practical point of view, if you take 4 40-foot containers and put these small modular atomic power stations, which for the record is 90% safer than the traditional building of nuclear power station, then we are basically talking about being able to plug and unplug alternative sources again, and with a different security risk and a whole different way. But maybe a better way, Adam, to address is that. So a journalist asked me a pretty smart question. He said, if you could only have one thing economically or market wise, what would it be? And of course, I was almost tempted to do the Midas mistake and saying I want everything to turn to gold and that I touch. But then it dawned on me that the answer is really, and that goes to what you believe in very much, that the energy is the center of everything, right? So in a perfect world, I said to myself, perfection would be if the marginal cost of energy was zero. And the reason why marginal cost of energy would at zero be perfect would be that we can do vertical farming, we can do desalination of water, we can address a lot of the temperature, a lot of the farming issues through having this ability of having close to zero cost of energy. On top of that, it would expand massively our ability to reach a quantum state of computing and everything else. And that would, in my opinion, and I think we agree on that. And I'm taking your words into mind, but I think productivity we released at such a rate that would just be mind-blowing if we have marginal cost. I actually think, as a simple principle, that the higher the price of energy is, the less productivity society will have. It's simply too expensive to run the world. But think about what we're doing right now in the world. It's exactly the opposite of making the marginal cost of energy cheap. We are making it marginally more expensive by a failed green transformation, which, and I'm probably sure made that clear, I'm fully for the green transformation. I just don't understand why electric vehicle is the outcome of this conversation. It should be that we make better grid network, we start doing cabling with carbon instead of with aluminium and copper. And I mean, there's so many things we can do from a perspective. And we could do a new Manhattan project this time just to create alternative energy sources and just take everything. I'm not pretending I know which will be the better energy, but it's absolutely certain that the only way right now with the amount of debt and the inability of society to reconstruct, the only way we change the world is through the marginal cost of energy going to zero. That I'm absolutely certain about. And that will release the biggest productivity gain. So you can argue sort of from a point of view of energy, we need to educate people to understand that everything starts with energy. Every single recession we've had started with energy. And by the way, every single food crisis we ever had, what did that start with? The energy prices going up, because that increases the fertilizer price. And right now, as you and I talk, Adam, the food prices globally is up 30%. I'm a farmer, as I think I've said a few times. Not that I planned that much, but I can tell you, I cannot afford to buy a new seed for next year and the fertilizer at that small farm I have, because it's simply devastatingly expensive for me to do this, and imagine a big farmer in Kansas, whatever the cost for him to just run his business. Adam, that's why I think that we are at a breaking point. That's why I think we don't have ability. It is the same issue again. The physical world is biting that financial world that continues to see everything as a reflection of the Fed action and cheap money. Cheap money is not going to change anything. More cheap money is going to change even less. It's going to make things worse. More fiscal is going to make the constraints worse. So I think it's probably, you will laugh when I say this, probably the most pessimistic I've ever been, because Adam, we're moving to a world of productivity where the marginal cost of capital has to go up relatively. You can argue if we're going to sustain what we have, then we have to have more negative real rates. And right now, for stating that fact, we have minus 550 basis point negative real rates in the US, while the five-year tells me I only have 2.2% inflation. I must be stupid, because I don't understand the world that has, it's spot at minus 5.5 and a future that tells me I'm going to have inflation, which is less than half of this. So I think for me, I think I hope 22 will be my best training year ever. I mean, I'm really psyched about these changes. What I'm not psyched about is the social consequence, which I think, again, I played this card early, but Carter, the 1970s going into the 1980s, I think we are in a Carter-like situation in terms of midterm. Carter taught the Biden administration that if you want to bite inflation, you bite it early. He did it late and lost the election on it. And the impact on the real economy when you get above this 3% threshold is just massive. So massive that he corrected Chair and Powell and Yellen. And look at every single advisor the White House has. Summers over the weekend. Jason Furman is out day in and day out. All of these people who advise White House are saying, we need to increase interest rate by three, four times next year.
Yeah, which is, to your point earlier, I mean, that is just a massive shift, a massive 180-degree turn than what they were singing just a couple of weeks ago, practically. So from my perspective, I think that's the type of medicine that we need to start to have to get inflation under control. But I shudder at the impact it's going to have on a global economy that is so over-leveraged and financial markets that are so addicted to cheap money forever and lots of it, right? So, all right, well, let's take a quick break from the negative side of things for a moment and get to your list of things that you are excited about. So as you look forward to 2022, what do you expect to be the biggest trends that are going to impact investors? We talked about some on the negative side, but what are some of the things that you're excited about?
Now I'm going to take a massive personal risk, Adam, because as you clear can tell, I'm over the age of 30, right? But I'm going to talk about blockchain and crypto and NFT.
All right. Good luck, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. May the gods be with me. But here it comes. So what we saw in 21 is a massive user case for the use of blockchain. I think what stands between the commercialization and the growing up of the industry of blockchain, crypto, and NFT is a big user case. The user case I see, the most dominant one, but followed by a few others, is the music industry. The music industry with Spotify at the lead and together with the record labels takes about 85-90% of an artist's revenue. With the new NFTs, you can make the same app and reverse the payout from 90% to everybody else to 90% to the artist. On top of that, you can build gaming interaction. You can do unique photos. You can do unique music bits that you can put onto this platform. So, as someone who advises directly and indirectly a number of businesses in this industry, despite my high age, they always have the biggest difficulty creating user cases or nodes, as they call them. I mean, if you have a blockchain that has 500 people working on it, it's a big network. Now all of a sudden, you have this music industry with millions upon millions of fans who could not care less what the IT expression or the platform expression of what they do, except they just want access to their artist. I know of a sounds odd, but a Ukrainian singer, she has 15 million followers. She's converted to NFT. And now I'm going to show how old I am. A number of artists, Katy Perry, Jason Carullo, or someone very famous, is also converting. A lot of these, you got to help me out. I'm lost, but a lot
I'm
of
sorry,
these,
buddy, you're on your own on this one.
But a lot of the very big artists is turning to NFT. I saw this morning that NBA now is selling NFTs. So they're selling your favorite team, your favorite player in a special situation. You can buy that picture as a unique feature, like you used to buy a baseball or shirt or whatever. I mean, it's exploding, Adam. It's absolutely exploding. And one of the reasons it doesn't get more carry is because of people you and I dominate. Look at us, two middle-aged guy, white, sits here and talks about the world among ourselves and pretend we know. But the young generation, and this plays to a second theme, which is, the biggest divide in the world is between the young and the old. How, if you were 25 years old today and you're going to build a fortune being a business person, would you go into asset management? No. Would you go into banking? No. Would you go into construction? No. What you would do is find something related to a blockchain and NFT or some business where you have an ability to at least have the optionality of 100%, 200, 1,000, 2,000% upside. Everything else is taken out by us. Our generations have closed all of the holes left or all of the ability to navigate. So I think we are forcing a whole generation onto a platform, which at the center of it has this ability to create their leverage against the rest of society. And the longer we are, the slower we are to adapt to this new world, the more they will be able to actually control that universe. I mean, gaming is another NFT example. But for me, the critical thing here is that, it may sound boring, and that probably shows my age, but I think that if I'm right about NFT taking off really massively in 22, then we're actually creating a space where there are cryptos and NFTs which sits with a commercial purpose. And then we have a lot of NFTs and cryptos that has no commercial purpose. And in my world, I would rather buy an NFT or a crypto that has a commercial value, sits on top of the blockchain, that has a, you know, millions upon millions of users being acting and operating on it, relatively speaking. So all of a sudden, we have a natural selection of the better or the worse of this industry, because, and I think that's exactly what it wants. So I think for me, and another anecdotal, as you know, I talk to a lot of hedge fund managers in the world. The biggest name you know in the industry, do you know what they do today exclusively? 50% of the trading is crypto and 50% is private equity, i.e., they're not buying any public listed companies. They're
Wow.
only doing private, and they are trading crypto because it has a high frequency, 100% volatility. If you're a good trader, you can manage it. And I think that is a clear testament to the world has changed without us noticing. What is happening is that the retail space has moved in where these hedge fund guys used to be in the public sector, in the public listing, and the private market has been the most, it's now become the most level, the most unsubstantiated facts in the world. But these guys know to navigate volatility. So for me, 22 on the technology side is all about blockchain. I could be totally wrong, and I'm again, let's disclaim, I'm 57 years old, so I'm totally unqualified to do this call. But when I my young crypto analyst is next to me, he th what he's seeing, what he's doing, what they're trading. The young guy sitting behind me who left job for the day, they do NFTs trading more than they trade stocks. And at first I go, I mean, why would you buy something you don't have? It's just a digital, anyone can do it. But that's not the case. The case is this is creating the user case that makes blockchain viable and commercial popular. So for that reason, Adam, I think 22 is a commercial year. And also then put it in, again, in a greater context. If you have a world which is including at an endpoint or where inflation is becoming higher and higher, how do you hedge that? You hedge it by finding something that moves at a higher rate than the inflation, right? So you need to be, you know, whether you want it or not, if you're a manager, an active manager today, you need to embrace that. And you secondly need to embrace the fact that you know, the 100% volatility is your friend, because if you rebalance monthly or weekly, it's not a big issue to deal with it in that respect. And if you're a good trader, it's not an issue. But for me, that is the sea change that all of a sudden, as a 57-year-old, I'm forced to move into a space which I think is growing up in 22.
All right, and I want to get in just a few minutes to sort of the active part of this discussion in terms of, hey, what could people do? You know, what might make sense for investors given some of these trends? But just sort of as a quick preview, it sounds like you will be increasing the percent of your portfolio allocation to cryptos and NFTs going forward.
Yeah, so I think I explained a 100-year portfolio last year, and I had 7% in crypto currency, and I've had that since the summer of 2020. So I have a constant 7%, meaning that in a month where crypto goes 100%, I have 14% at the end of the month, I sell it down to 7%. I always have 7%. What I will do, however, Adam, is in my equity portfolio allocation, which is 35%, I've been very classically just keeping to the major indices. It's low cost, it's really the same return. So NASDAQ and S&P ETFs is what I use there. Now I want to add two components to the upside of my negative view, which is I want to buy, as you say, some crypto operators and potentially even miners in that space. And what we're going to talk about shortly, I presume, next gen medicine on the upside. So I'm really just keeping my crypto exposure, but I'm building on my equity exposure to be more reflective of this growing market. And again, I have no idea who's going to win and who's going to lose. But, you know, with young, great equity analysts in my team, I'm buying the basket that we have for that sector overall, which is, you know, 25, 30 names, equal weight in that respect.
Okay, great. All right, well, let's head on to some of the other big trends that have you excited. And you just mentioned one of them too, which was medical advances. So why don't we go there next?
Yeah, so I had the pleasure of kind of being forced to talk to Woods, what's her name? Katie Woods at ARK Investments.
Yeah, Kathy Wood?
Kathy Woods, and super intelligent, super bright, super research lady. I came in kind of skeptical because I'm just an old geezer who doesn't like any change, right? But it dawned on me that ARK Investment and certainly her fund is not a, you know, you don't buy that because you want to have 30% equity exposure. You really buy it because you want to be positive about the future. You buy it because you want an optionality of what can change, because technology comes through, because the evolution of mankind is always constantly moving forward, and there's enough lottery tickets out there you can buy to reflect that. And that made me think about the overall structure of what inside the future is what gets me most excited. And of course, being a typical economist from a reverse engineering perspective, I said, actually, the biggest upside must be where I can save the biggest amount of money for society, because we have a demographic deficit, we have a growing population, we have an increased cost of healthcare, especially in the US, where you have doubled the, you know, 2 to 3 times higher expense per capita than you have in Denmark, which I think is perceived to be one of the best medical system in the world. So what can actually change this equation? And that is the fact that we've moved to this CRISPR, we're gene editing, we can regenerate organs and everything. So we've actually increased in medical terms, our resilience, our ability to come back from diseases has improved. But most importantly, think about if we could change the model from one where we spend 95% of treating clients or people who are sick in hospital to one where we spend at a bare minimum 50% diagnostic and 50% treatment. The society down upside on this, Adam, it's just so big that I can't ignore it. And then I start looking at the numbers from a bottom-up perspective, and mind you, these are inflated. But you know, that industry talks about a CAGR of 23% for the next 10 years. You know, so here is something that gets me excited on an emotional, psychological level, because I know society can save a huge amount of money if we just move to diagnostics instead of treating people. And I know your old partner and you has been on this case for many, many years in terms of what goes on. So you are far better expert on all this than I am. But for me as an investor, if you show me 23% CAGR and it is an optionality on the future inside a relatively, let's just call it a neutral equity view, I get totally excited, because society can, you know, Kathy Woods said to me, you know, inside the next 10 to 12 years, you'll be able to diagnose cancer as it emerges in the early stages. And you can do precision messaging, you can do, if needed, cell generation, regeneration, and the likes. And we have that ability already. It's not like we can't do it. Making it commercial is a different story. And being allowed to roll it out in the healthcare system is a different one. But I tell you what, the single biggest need we have over the next 20 years is to reduce the cost of healthcare. This is what's going to do it. Diagnostics early, getting in with preventive medicine relatively to treatment medicine, and just investment. The problem is, I need you and Martin to tell me which stocks to buy in this space. But I'm really excited about this story. And on a personal level, I'm going to spend all my time trying to understand this next year.
Yeah, well, you know, those of us who are on the back half of 50, you know, this becomes sort of a higher personal
conquest
relevance going forward. Wow. So did you say 23% CAGR for the next 20 years?
10 years.
Okay. Still even for the next decade. Yeah. You know, it seems like, you know, an investing sector that, you know, both is of interest as just an investor, but you can also feel good about the societal impact of
exactly of
the results as well. Okay. I know that there was one other it's sort of in your list of major steps forward that you had seen, you were looking at in 2020. You also mentioned massive activation of female investors. Can you comment on that for a moment?
Yeah. So now you're referring to the race predictions, of course. And I think Now I'm going to get into trouble, but I really don't understand women hasn't already risen to the challenge. I think it's increasingly signs of that, and I think I personally get more invite to talk at women-only or female-only seminars and groups that gathers to create a forest. But my colleague on the fixed time, she came up with this concept that why isn't there a Reddit army of women trading the markets and going after patriarchy in the system? So in other words, if we can get Hertz, who at the time was not a from a bottom-up perspective, a very good company, if you can elevate the price of that company just based on getting a number of people together, what couldn't you do in terms of forcing changes to what is clearly needed in terms of C-suites, in terms of boards, but most importantly, Adam, this is 2021. Why is there a pay gap between men and women in the same job? It makes zero sense. And actually, the more sophisticated the country rate itself, it seems like the gap is bigger in those countries that sees themselves as being very egalitarian and the likes. It's just, it's a matchup upside struggle that they failed to win. But why don't they then go to what really matters for the market? And that is the money's talks, right? A good old movie from, what's his name? Show me the money, right? And I think to a large extent, what we'll see from women over the next 2 to 3 years, show me the money. They just will only support companies that are positive for closing that pay gap. They will only be positive for companies that has a diversified group of management and a diversified agenda. Because end of the day, you know, there's no way it should be like it is. And I wholly fully root for this change. And I'm to be honest, I'm surprised there isn't a women only bank or women only broker or whatever out there, because I was just thinking about it, even from my own bank. If you look at our advertisement, whatever, it's blue, it's dark, it's cars, it's boat, it's all male dominated themes relatively to a world where, you know, women certainly are just as good as men as traders, but in terms of the actual purse they have to spend, it's probably bigger. You know, certainly even in the most patriotic countries like the Middle East, it is the women who sits on the finances. So it's for me that is an upside, but it's more difficult to play. I think that what we talked about prior in terms of next gen medicine and you know, even the redefinition of green energy and not is clear plays. The female side is really for the women to dictate the agenda, not again a 50 or something male in Denmark that decides that.
Yeah. If you thought you were going to get in trouble, go pining about cryptos. Yeah, maybe you're on even dicier ground here. But no,
I think whatever this ends, I'm going to be in trouble with one.
No. It is a great point, Sven, and it is interesting. You know, when you look at both sort of the power that we've seen demonstrated over the past year by the sort of the Wall Street Bets crowd, right, where you've been able to get, you know, an interest group together to affect, you know, real change at companies, at least change in the stock price. You know, there's no bigger interest group than 50% of the global population. In fact, I think there's slightly more women than men on the planet. So it does sort of seem like an inexorable force that should come into its full expression at some point, and why not in 2022? I'm glad you mentioned it too, just very quickly. Folks, I've been talking to some of the top women in finance, sort of in our space here, and am talking to them about putting together a roundtable. And it just happens to be made up of these women. It's not necessarily supposed to be just a women's roundtable, but it is a roundtable of very successful, very smart women. Nobody is fully, it's not locked in yet, but under discussion is Stephanie Pomboy, Danielle DiMartino Booth, Lynn Alden, and Ivy Zellman, all of whom have appeared on this program in the past couple of months. If that's something you would like to see on this channel, a macro roundtable made up of those ladies and perhaps some other, some of their esteemed colleagues, if you'd like to see that and really want to have that happen, just let me know in the comment section below this video. All right, Steen. So moving on here, let's, last time you were on, you were extremely generous and just opening the full kimono and letting us know how the Saxo portfolio was positioned in terms of what percentage you had invested in different asset classes. Are you comfortable sharing the current allocation with us here?
Absolutely.
Our interview with Steen continues over in part 2, which will be released tomorrow once we're done editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as the little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to click the like button too while you're at it. And as always, if you'd appreciate a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your portfolio, keeping in mind the risks and opportunities Steen has highlighted here, just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. You know, this is particularly beneficial to do here at the end of the year to get your portfolio well positioned for 2022 right from the start. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our video interview with Steen Jacobson.